Today at Reader's Corner, Ilyan Wu, author of Master Slave Husband Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1848, a young enslaved couple, Ellen and William Craft, achieved one of the boldest feats of self-emancipation in American history. Posing as master and slave, while sustained by their love as husband and wife, they made their escape together across more than 1,000 miles. In her latest book, Master Slave Husband Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom, author Ilyan Wu weaves together this tumultuous love story against the backdrop of a monumental bid for freedom. Ilyan Wu is the best-selling author of The Great Divorce, a 19th-century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times. Her writing has appeared in the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and other publications. She holds a PhD in English from Columbia University, and she's with us today at Reader's Corner. Ilyan Wu, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
What a tale this is. I know the Crafts wrote their own narrative of this journey a long time ago, and of course it wasn't the 21st century with the enormous ability of the press to spread the good word. It just seems like this tale should have been told years ago, but it wasn't. I guess the question I have for you is, how did you find this story?
Well, I guess maybe I would make a slight correction there, because they did tell their story, which is why we have access to it today, which is how I got to it. They wrote, as you said, this incredible narrative in 1860. It didn't get around quite as much as one would have liked. It wasn't like a big bestseller like Douglas's works or Brown's works, but it was published in two editions in the UK where the Crafts were at the time. And it's really an explosive narrative. And for me, that was my first point of contact. I am so grateful for Professor Robert O'Mealy at Columbia University for assigning this text for a graduate seminar I took on the literature of passing, because it just, from the first opening line, just kind of blew me away. And it felt to me like a spoken text. And when I think about it now, it's just kind of like all came together as I was thinking about this the last couple of days. But the Crafts told their story. They spoke it before they actually wrote it down. They spoke it all across New England in another like crazy 1,000-mile journey. So it makes sense to me that it would have almost this kind of oral feeling to it when you read. I mean, it just comes off the page and it makes you want to know more. So that was how I got to know the Crafts.
Well, as I told you before we went on the air, I saw CBS Sunday Morning Show where your book and you were featured and they told the story. But of course, they only have a little bit of time to do so. Mm-hmm. But when I picked up your book afterwards, what really got me was, again, the piece on CBS focused on the journey for the most part. Mm-hmm. And when I got into your book, what I found so enthralling was that when you get to the North, when you follow the Crafts through the North, I learned so much about the anti-slavery movement, about the people within it, that I'm sorry, it must have escaped my general American history text I had many, many, many years ago. And then that's what I found so enjoyable about the book, was not only the incredible journey, that's a page turner that keeps you going page by page, but then you learn so much about these folks. But let's start with learning more about the Crafts. These were not the kinds of slaves that were toiling in cotton fields. I wonder if you could share with our listeners just what their backgrounds were as they prepared for this escape.
Yeah, so you're very right. They were not enslaved on plantations. They were living in Macon, Georgia at the time of their escape. So they were both skilled craftspeople or artisans, and they had an unusual degree of mobility and access to information because of this. So Ellen was enslaved by her biological half-sister in Macon, Georgia, and she had sort of a privileged position within the household, and she was a seamstress as well as sort of a lady's maid. And so she had information within the household. She had sort of better food, better clothing. And she had, this is pretty critical, a space of her own. This is critical and really unusual. I mean, there were other enslaved people in cities like Macon who were working somewhat independently, as Ellen and William both were. But she had this, they call it a cottage in their narrative, a place where she worked, but also where she sort of, she slept, and she could keep some measure of privacy. And that became key as the crafts assembled the different parts of her costume and got ready to flee bondage. William was also enslaved in Macon, Georgia, by a different enslaver, a young man who basically kind of, William made an arrangement with the cabinet maker to whom he had been apprenticed since she was a young child. He made this arrangement where the enslaver would receive a yearly sum from the cabinet maker for William's services. But then William wasn't living with the enslaver. He lived elsewhere. He boarded elsewhere. And he had sort of time before and after his normal day with the cabinet maker. And he used this to earn his own wages. This was technically illegal, but it was something that some people did, and that Maconites kind of, you know, let go, white Maconites kind of let go, because it worked out well for all the different parties involved. And William worked at a hotel, and he earned extra wages doing jobs in this cabinet making shop. And through that accumulated capital, they were able to finance this incredible journey.
So tell us about Ellen's birthright and skin color and how that really helps them pull off posing as her as a white slave owner traveling with her slave, who is actually her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a critical piece, because so Ellen was the daughter of a woman named Maria, who was enslaved by a man named James Smith, a white man named James Smith. And from him, she inherited, and actually possibly from her mother's side as well, because she's been described as being a quadroon or of one quarter African ancestry. So that means that 3 out of 4 of her grandparents, or the equivalent, were white. So she had such a fair complexion, and she so resembled her biological father, that she was frequently mistaken for a child of her father's legitimate legal household, which caused problems for her, because he had a wife who had other children and a huge amount of rage at this young child who, through no fault of her own, bore this strong resemblance to her father. And so it was this woman, Mistress Smith, the wife of Ellen's father, James Smith, who had her given away when she was 11 years old as a wedding present to the Smith's own daughter, Eliza. And that's how Ellen becomes the servant, the slave of her own biological half-sister.
Yeah. Well, we know from the history of slavery that many of these very young girls were raped. I don't think we know the details on this particular situation, but using Ellen and William as an example, share with us how other families that you mention in the book were ripped apart from their parents. I think it happened to William too, didn't it?
It did. I mean, both rape and physical separation were commonplace. And I should note, for example, with Ellen's parentage, that, I mean, there's no such thing as the rape of an enslaved woman at this time. A man, an enslaver, male or female, owned and had physical control of the people that he or she held in bondage, like total control. And there was nothing in James Smith's law books that would have said it was illegal for him to have raped Ellen Craft's mother, or anyone else for that matter. So rape and also family separation, those were huge specters that really kind of loomed over the lives of all enslaved people, no matter how quote unquote privileged they were. And as you said, William saw his parents sold because they were losing value to his first enslaver, Hugh Craft, as I discovered. And he saw each one of his siblings sold one after the other before being sold himself. And one of the major reasons why the crafts decide to go on this journey of mutual self-emancipation is they just cannot bear the thought of losing one another or losing any children that they might have in the same way that they had been lost to their own parents.
You're listening to Ilyan Wu. She is the author of Master Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. So Ellen's going to put herself on this train car with white people. And mm-hmm. even though she's light skinned and she's a woman, she has to pass herself off as a man. So tell us how William and Helen concoct this disguise approach to their journey that works for Ellen as the master slaveholder.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it amazing that she crosses lines of gender and race and class and ability? I mean, she has to do all these four things together, as the crafts will later learn when they go on another journey where Ellen is not passing as a man. She's passing as a white woman. You know, the sight of a white woman traveling alone with a black man is unsettling to people around them, even in the North, even in Canada. Mm-hmm. So her passing as a man was a critical part of the disguise. They come to this idea just 4 days, they say, before they make their escape. So it has to happen really fast, which means they have to go out and get ready-made clothes. Ellen sews the pants for herself. She's very small, and I actually think that that's probably the major reason why those have to be closely fit. The other clothing items, William goes from store to store. He can't afford for anybody to get suspicious, so he has to buy these items in different places, and it's also illegal for him to be making these purchases. So he brings these clothing items one by one, and in this cottage space that Ellen has somewhat privately, he has a cabinet that he's made for her, or like a set of drawers, so they're able to enclose these clothing items in this cabinet until the time comes for them to embark on this journey.
So what are the major cities that the crafts have to navigate in order to arrive at Philadelphia, which is the free North? This is an incredible train ride.
Oh my gosh, it is the ride of their lives. And it starts in Macon. It actually should not have been as complicated as it was. It was supposed to be three stops. So they're supposed to go from Macon to Savannah by train, and then take a steamboat from Savannah to Charleston. And then last, there's a steamboat that goes out of Charleston and is supposed to go straight to Philadelphia. The problem is, as soon as they get to Charleston, they learn that the last of those steamers has left for the season. And so they have to go on what's called the overland mail route. And this is the journey that stops a gazillion times between Charleston and Philadelphia. I mean, they go through Richmond, they go through North Carolina, then they go to Virginia, they sort of creep all the way up, and they go through these major cities. They have to go through DC. I mean, it's just endless. And it's pretty amazing that they were able to navigate all these stops without a map, without any kind of guidance, with probably no previous knowledge.
And again, we don't give everything away, because this is just like a novel where you're waiting to see what's going to happen in the next chapter. But let's talk about Charleston for a minute, because again, what I so much enjoyed about the book was the opportunity to learn more about the slave trade. And in a moment, of course, when we get to the North, I'll learn so much more about the anti-slavery movement. But when they get to Charleston, Ellen has to buy a ticket, mm-hmm. purchase a ticket for the next part of her journey. And she does that at the customs house.
Yes.
And in back of the customs house is the sugar house. And what a name that is for what it really is.
Yeah.
Please tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, so I there are two houses that really must have stood out in Ellen's memory of Charleston. And I guess you'll have to read the book to see how she remembers Charleston. But there's the custom house, which is where she has to really pass herself off again as a gentleman, get past the signatures that she would have to provide for her slave, William. And then looming sort of behind this custom house on the shore side is the so-called sugar house. It, you know, it's formed on this old sugar factory site, but it's basically a house of torture, just a terrible house of torture where enslaved people were sent for punishment. And this is a place that the crafts, that Ellen in particular, is familiar with, having been in Charleston before. The crafts actually mention the sugar house in the early part of their narrative. They say they're talking about Ellen's mistress, her biological half-sister, and how, you know, she didn't have Ellen sent to the sugar house where she might have. And she was, you know, she wasn't as bad as she could have been. And I remember thinking at the time, research, like trying to figure out what is the sugar house, and then learning that it was in Charleston and thinking, why would they be referring to a sugar house in Charleston if they're living in Macon? So that was sort of the first clue that there was something, there was more significance to Charleston than I originally thought. But this place is just, I mean, it is a nightmare. They have a high fence with glass shards over the edge of it so that people can't escape. And I can't even, you know, begin to describe the eyewitness testimonies of what went on within those walls.
I mean, it's a torture chamber, basically, with things like the perpetual staircase that they'd put people on after they beat them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so hard to believe. You know, this is a relatively small part of this journey, but it didn't occur to me until you brought it up later in the book, by the time they get to the north, sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to see this couple maneuvering their way through this south that's so dangerous for them. Quite another to think that they really didn't get any sleep along the way. And in fact, at one point, in one of the final legs of the journey, I think, Ellen fears William is missing. He's not showing up.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Oh, I mean, so never mind the 4 days that they are awake and alert and, you know, in this sort of fight or flight mode for the 4 days of the journey. They were up four nights before that too. Cause remember, they only got the idea, yeah, they said, or they only started making this detailed plan 4 days before they left. So they're up four nights and then they're up another four nights. And then they are almost at Philadelphia. They are so close. And, you know, you mentioned this before that there are all these sort of, you know, super suspenseful moments. And of course, we all know that they make it, but even me, even knowing everything, I mean, my heart stops every time I think about that particular moment. But let's exactly. just say that William falls asleep at a most inopportune moment. Yeah. And then Ellen has to figure out what she's going to do when she thinks that she's lost him. And for me, that is really one of the most terrifying moments of the journey. It's the moment not at which they think they're going to be attacked, not at which they think they're going to be jailed or seized or anything like that, but a quiet moment where Ellen thinks that she may be alone in this love story, love journey. And that's something, at this part of the journey at least, I don't think was foremost in their minds, which is what makes it so surprising and so devastating in that moment.
Right. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Ilyan Wu, author of Master Slave, Husband, Wife. The book tells the remarkable true story of Ellen and William Craft, who escaped slavery with Ellen passing as a wealthy disabled white man and William passing as his slave. Well, let's jump to Philadelphia. We're going to talk about the North now. Mm-hmm. And what happens to them up in the North. First, it's Philadelphia, then they decide to go to Boston, and then they go to Canada, and then they're on their way to London. That's the short version. But if I can back it up a little bit, they arrive in Philadelphia. And, you know, what really gets me about this book is I spent so much time thinking about the idea of slavery, the immorality of slavery, and how in some ways, sometimes people give slave holders and those who believed in slavery a pass because, well, that was then. That mm-hmm. was before we knew better. Mm-hmm. And yet what you've uncovered in your book is volumes of examples of people in the North, white abolitionists who knew better, who knew and understood the immorality of slavery. And maybe we should start, I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of time on this because we don't have a lot of time, but Barclay and Mary Ivins in Philadelphia. Ellen mm-hmm. calls them the first act of great and disinterested kindness by white people she has ever experienced in her life. And that part of your book is loaded with examples like this, but I'd rather have you tell it.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a beautiful moment in their narrative because the Crafts have arrived in Philadelphia, arrived in Pennsylvania, arrived in a free state. And, you know, we were just talking about how exhausted, physically exhausted they are by the end of this. They haven't been able to sleep. I mean, they are just overloaded. And Ellen is not physically well in the aftermath of this. And so she's sort of laying low in various sites in the state. And a man, a Quaker man named Barclay Ivins, offers to take the Crafts into their home, his home with his wife, Mary. And again, they're moving sort of secretly. This is really the Underground Railroad now. And they make it out to Pensbury Manor. And I've been on that cold shore myself. And it's really kind of in the middle of the middle of nowhere. And they pull up in the wagon and they see the Ivins' house, and it's, you know, it's nighttime and the house is lit up, and they see his wife and the daughters. And that's the first moment where Ellen realizes, wait a second, these are white people. She had thought that Barclay Ivins, was a fair skinned person of color like herself. And as soon as she sees his wife is actually an Irish immigrant, and I'm sure she had some sort of accent at that point too. But when they greet her, Ellen is like, oh my gosh, I am turning right around. And it's kind of almost a comical moment in the narrative, and a really powerful one where Ellen also learns to put aside, as she describes, her own prejudices, her own fears about people of another race. Mm-hmm. But going back to what you said earlier, I mean, I think there is this idea that we say that, oh, this was a different time. You know, people didn't know better. But the more you look, the more I look and the more I read, I mean, we are all human beings. And no matter what age it is, I think there is a common sense of what's right and wrong. It's just a matter of how much we're able to delude ourselves into justifying that something like slavery is actually tenable. People right. did know, and not just in the North, but North and South, once they could behold. People knew.
So let's talk about life in the North for the Crafts, and the reason why, even though they're in the free North, they're not safe. And mm-hmm. if you could just sum up for us the impact of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, and then they revised it in 1850, which is right about the time the Crafts are getting to the North. And it was even backed up by a clause in the United States Constitution.
Yes.
This is dangerous territory, even though it's the free North. You can explain what happens to these folks when it comes to these slaveholders who send people North to capture.
Yeah, I was just going to begin with the Constitution, because in the 18th century, there is what is known as the Fugitive Slave Clause. It doesn't actually, the word slavery is not included very purposefully in the Constitution. However, there is this clause that says that if you owe labor in one state and you move to another, you still owe that the terms of that labor in that state that you left behind. And this clause empowers enslavers to pursue the labor that they are owned. In other words, the fugitive slaves, and bring them back to the state in which their services, are due to them. So there's the Constitution. There is the original Fugitive Slave Law, which empowers enslavers more specifically to be able to go recapture fugitive slaves. But it was said that it lacked teeth, and northern states were coming up with all kinds of different ways to get around the original Fugitive Slave Law with personal liberty laws and such. And so enslavers by 1850 were getting really, really frustrated that what's the use of having, how can you enforce any guarantee of this institution that they felt like they were promised at the time of the Constitution when enslaved people were crossing borders and nothing could be done to bring them back. So the nation is kind of at this crossroads crisis moment, almost a breaking point, like a near divorce. If we're looking at North and South as kind of two married partners that are trying to figure out, well, what are the terms that we need in order to be able to keep going on in this union and this partnership? And that's exactly right when the crafts cross that line. And so their journey is intersecting with this critical point in the journey of the nation. And they become a test case for the fugitive slave law, which passes.
Well, as I said earlier, they find their way to England, to London, after realizing that it's just not safe, even in Canada, if somebody's going to kidnap one or both of them and send them back to their slaveholders. And we're running out of time, and so I want to get to one aspect of their time in London. First of all, they have children. You can comment on that. But they want to be educated, and they have not had an opportunity to do that. They are illiterate, at least Ellen is, I think. And so here comes along a name out of English history, Lord Byron.
Yeah.
tell us how Lord Byron ends up indirectly, you might say, playing a role in their education, which of course they bring back to America later in their lives and create a school. But
yeah, again, I mean, isn't it amazing? Like, I saw people have compared the crafts in some ways to the, you know, the Zelig character in Woody Allen's old film, or Forrest Gump, like all these different people, all these different connections with the, you know, president of the United States and these major figures, including the wife of Lord Byron, Lady Byron, who has the school in Ockham, England, in Surrey. And this has been the craft's lifelong dream, is this pursuit of literacy. One of the reasons why they try to escape. And Ellen especially has had very limited options to learn. And it's something that she's really hungered for. In fact, the crafts were just about to start at a night school when they were in Boston when the whole fugitive slave crisis came up, and we didn't talk about this, but slave hunters come from Georgia to try to capture them. So it was just this huge frenzy. They're all over England. There's, you know, become celebrities in England too. And finally they arrive at this potential resting place where they can learn these skills and acquire this literary power, which they will then use later on in their lives to tell their story in yet other ways. As you said, they also bring back the education they acquire in post-1870 America at a really sort of dangerous juncture in our history after the Civil War. They decide to come back. I mean, these people are just endlessly inventive, both with their journey and with the journey of their entire lives. I think it's one of the things, I mean, it's what makes them so extraordinary and really ultimately heroic,
right,
and larger than life.
And what's amazing about Ellen is that from the earliest moments of her figuring out how to escape the South, she wants to deal with the fact that she's afraid she'll never see her mother again. And so she's committed somehow, some way in the course of her life to reunite with her mother. Tell us how that happens.
Oh, she does everything in her power. And this is a love story in so many ways. And the original subtitle was, in fact, Master Slave, Husband, Wife, an American love story. But the love story begins with that mother's love. And in some ways, it closes with that mother's love. I actually, you know, I listened to the audiobook version of my own book, and to hear Leon Nixon describe this incredible reunion between mother and child, it moved me, and I hope it will move others as well.
Well, Ilyan, this book is going to move anybody who picks it up and reads it, because I think it's one of the best things I've read this year. I can't recommend it more highly to our listening audience. Again, the name of the book is Master Slave, Husband, Wife, an epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. The author is Ilyan Wu. Ilyan, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's been a true pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.